bookstore, and I'm sure she'd be happy to sign copies after the reading. And I would also hope that she'll join us for a reception following the reading. She'll be just outside the auditorium. The next two readers on our schedule are Michael Collier on Wednesday, October 4th, here in Modern Languages. And he is a graduate of the University of Arizona's MFA program and will be returning to Tucson, so I'm sure he won't miss that one. He will be followed by the fiction writer, Jeffrey Eugenides, who is the author of an astounding first novel called The Virgin Suicides, and he will be reading on Wednesday, October 18th, also here in Modern Languages. As I'm sure you know, the National Endowment for the Arts has suffered considerable setbacks and severe budget cuts in the last few months, and readings like the one you're at this evening are in jeopardy. The University of Arizona Poetry Center has in the past received funds from the National Endowment for the Arts, and they have helped to underwrite a portion of our reading series. I encourage you to become involved in a dialogue with our senators and representatives about the issue of funding for the arts, and the literary arts in particular. There's information in the back, on one of the chairs set up in the back, from the Literary Network, which is an advocacy group that is doing work on behalf of American writers and readers. I encourage you to get in touch with them if you want more information, or to call me at the Poetry Center, and I'd be happy to talk to you about it. Patty Ann Rogers is the author of 6 books of poetry, the most recent of which is Firekeeper, New and Selected Poems, published by Milkweed Editions in 1994. Firekeeper was chosen by Publishers Weekly as one of the best books of poetry to be published in 1994 and received the Natalie Ornish Poetry Award from the Texas Institute of Letters, and, which we learned just this week, is a finalist for the Lenore Marshall Prize, which is given jointly by The Nation magazine and the Academy of American Poets for the best book of poems published in the past year. We're pleased to be able to share this time of great anticipation with Patty Ann. Rogers' other awards have included 2 NEA fellowships, a Guggenheim fellowship, and a poetry fellowship from the Lannan Foundation. She teaches semesters in the creative writing program at the University of Arkansas and is currently on the faculty of American University in St. Louis. Patty Ann Rogers is engaged in what the poet Louise Glick has referred to as the steady upward labor of being a poet. She is a writer at work, taking as her subject no less than science and the natural world, religion, inasmuch as any careful study of nature is religious in its exactitude, and the human experience as seen through the refractory lens of the material world. Rogers finds meaning and poetry under rocks inside saguaro cactus, or in the aura and mythology of we create around enigmatic natural figures, such as the white deer or Steller's jays avoiding the death site of one of their own. Rogers has produced some of the most stunning lyric moments about nature and has been lauded by her for her loving dedication to earthly space. Terry Tempest Williams has called Rogers' poems, quote, translations of our dreaming life. And nature writer Barry Lopez has said, quote, if angels were to agree upon a language to describe creation, a tone of voice and a point of view that would adequately celebrate the divine, these would be the poems they would write. Patty Ann Rogers takes her place among what has evolved as a distinctly American genre that features writers grappling with issues of humanity's place in the natural world, a world defined by the actual and metaphorical existence of the frontier. From Emerson to Thoreau, Edwin Muir and Willa Cather, Marianne Moore and Amy Clampett, and on to Rogers and her contemporaries. Rogers does as her predecessors have done and explores the very fabric of what it means to be alive, to be breathing and thinking in a partial world. It's my pleasure to introduce Patty Ann Rogers.
That was a beautiful introduction. Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here and proud to have become a part of this tradition of the Poetry Center here. I give a lot of readings, or have over the past several years, but it seems like I'm always going somewhere I've never been before, so a big country. Anyway, I've never been to Tucson before, so I'm glad to be here and to take part in Gary Navin's here. I was just going to say the stinking hot desert, right? But that's not my phrase. I didn't make that up. All the poems I'm going to read are from The Firekeeper. I like to go back to earlier poems and kind of pair them with more recent poems and find connections when I put the poems I select for a reading together, seeing connections in poems that were maybe written several years apart. It's kind of interesting to me to do that. So the first two poems I'm going to read tonight are a kind of poem I like to write, which is an attempt to see if I can't prove something with language. You know, I have, maybe all poets secretly have the belief that if they just get something said right, it would have to be true. So I keep working at that. The first one is titled On the Existence of the Soul. How confident I am it is there. Don't I bring it as if it were enclosed in a fine leather case to particular places solely for its own sake? Haven't I set it down before the variegated canyon and the undeviating bald salt dome? Don't I feed it on ivory calcium and ruffled shell bellies, shore boulders, on the side of the petrel motionless over the sea, its splayed feet hanging? Don't I make sure it apprehends the invisibly fine spray more than once? I have seen that it takes in every detail I can manage concerning the garden wall and its borders. I have listed for it the comings and goings of 100 species of insects explicitly described. I have named the chartreuse stripe and the fimbriated antenna, the bulb thorax and the multiple eye. I have sketched the brilliant wings of the trumpet vine and invented new vocabularies describing interchanges between rocks and their crevices, between the holly lip and its concept of itself. And if not for its sake, why would I go out into the night alone and stare deliberately straight up into 15 billion years ago and more? I have cherished it. I have named it. By my own solicitations, I have proof of its presence. Well, were you convinced? Must be something there, otherwise what are we doing all this for? The second poem is also another attempt at a proof of a kind. And I read this poem one summer, and my husband happened to be in the audience, and there were two men sitting in front of him. And one, when I said I was going to read this poem, one turned to the other one and said, I'll bet you she can't get through it without stumbling. And the other one took the bet. Anyway, I got through it without stumbling. But after my husband told me this, and I realized somebody thought this was hard to do, I can't do it anymore. So anyway, so don't place any bets on me, but we'll see if I get, I'll try. In addition to faith, hope, and charity, I'm sure there's a God in favor of drums. Consider their pervasiveness, the thump, thump, and slide of waves on a stretched hide of beach, the rising beat and slap of their crests against shore baffles, the rapping of otters cracking mollusks with stones, woodpeckers beak banging, the beaver's whack of his tail paddle, the ape playing the bam on chest, the million tickering rolls of rain off the flat leaves and razor rims of the forest. And we know the noise of our own inventions, snare and kettle, bongo, conga, big bass, toy tin, timbals, tambourine, tom-tom. But the heart must be the most pervasive drum of all. Imagine hearing all together every tinny snare of every heartbeat in every jumping mouse and harvest mouse, sagebrush vole and least shrew living across the prairie, and add to that cacophony the individual staccato tickings inside all gnatcatchers, kingbirds, kestrels, rock doves, pine warblers, crossing, crisscrossing each other in the sky, the sound of their beatings overlapping with the singular hammerings of the hearts of cougar, coyote, weasel, badger, pronghorn, thunderous bass of the black bear, and on deserts too all the knackings, the flutterings inside wart snakes, whiptails, racers and sidewinders, earless lizards, cactus owls, plus the clamors undersea, slow booming in the breasts of beluga and bowhead, uniform wrappings in a passing school of cod or bib, the thitterings of bat rays and needlefish. Imagine the earth carrying this continuous din, this multifarious festival of pulsing thuds, stutters, and drummings wheeling on and on across the universe. This must be proof of a power existing somewhere, definitely in favor of such a racket. Anyway, I think I did get through that, didn't I? All those thitterings and stutterings and I just think they all are out there this very minute. Well, I'm going to talk about one of those little small creatures. I grew up in Missouri and really had my background in a forest. So I was always under trees. Well, when we moved to Houston, or just outside of Houston, I had a very different environment to get used to, because we lived on the side of Houston that doesn't have trees, because part of it does. Part of it, Houston used to be the beach of a ancient sea, but we lived on the side that was the sea bottom. Anyway, it's a kind of a Beaumont clay soil out there. Anyway, we didn't have any trees. So this was the first time I had ever really actually seen the moon rise from the horizon and seen it full and seen it go clear across the sky and sink, and the same way with the sun. And we lived across from a field, and I knew there were mice in that field because our cat would bring home one every once in a while. Unwilling visitor. Anyway, so I thought about how that the sky just came right down flat to the earth, and I had just never thought of that before, and I thought about the mouse out in the field, and so this is a poem that rose from that kind of vision, and the title is Being Accomplished. Balancing on her haunches, the mouse can accomplish certain things with her hands. She can pull the hull from a barley seed in paper-like pieces the size of threads. She can turn and turn a crumb to create smaller motes the size of her mouth. She can burrow in sand and grasp one single crystal grain with both of her hands. A quarter of a dried pea can fill her palm. She can hold the earless, eyeless head of her furless baby and push it to her teeth. The hollow of its mouth must feel like the invisible confluence sucking continually deep inside a pink flower. And the mouse is almost compelled to see everything. Her hand held up against the night sky can scarcely hide Venus or Polaris, or even a corner of the crescent moon. It can cover only a fraction of the blue moth's wing. Its shadow could never mar or blot enough of the evening to matter. Imagine the mouse with her spider-sized hands holding to a branch of dead hawthorn in the middle of the winter field tonight. Picture the night pressing in around those ends, forced simply by their presence to fit its great black bulk exactly around every hair and every pin-like nail, forced to outline perfectly every needle-thin bone without crushing one, to carry its immensity right up to the precise boundary of flesh, but no farther. Think how the heavy weight of infinity, expanding outward in all directions forever, is forced nevertheless to mold itself right here and now to every peculiarity of those appendages. And even the mind, capable of engulfing the night sky, capable of enclosing infinity, capable of surrounding itself inside any contemplation, has been obliged for this moment to accommodate the least grasp of that mouse, the dot of her knuckle, the accomplishment of her slightest intent. Well, I'm going to read a couple of poems now that really have nothing to do with this stinking hot desert, but I will read a stinking hot desert poem in a minute. But I hope you know I don't really think the desert is stinking hot, but it's a phrase I've gotten used to hearing. Anyway, the first poem I'm going to read that doesn't have one single thing to do with the desert is called Rolling Naked in the Morning Dew. And I think that's probably because you wouldn't want to try that around here. Supposing you even had dew. Do you ever have dew? Oh, you do have dew. Okay. You have dew? But I've seen a lot of plants that I don't think I'd want to roll naked over. Just in the few hours that I've been here. So, anyway, this we have to imagine, right? We have to project ourselves into a different landscape. Rolling naked in the morning dew, out among the wet grasses and wild barley-covered meadows, backside, frontside, through the white clover and feather pea bush, over spongy tussocks and shaggy mane mushrooms, the abandoned nests of larks and bobolinks, face to face with vole trails, snail niches, jelly slug eggs. Or in a stone-walled garden, level with the stemmed bulbs of orange and scarlet tulips, cricket carcasses, the bent blossoms of sweet William, shoulder over shoulder, leg over leg, clear to the ferny edge of the goldfish pond. Some people believe in the rejuvenating powers of this act, naked as a toad in the forest, belly and hips, thighs and ankles drenched in the dew-filled gulches of oak leaves, in the soft fall beneath yellow birches, all of the skin exposed directly to the killy cry of the kingbird, the buzzing of grasshopper sparrows, those calls merging with the dawn-red mists of crimson steeplebush, entering the bare body then, not merely through the ears, but through the skin of every naked person, willing every event and potentiality of a damp transforming dawn to enter. Lily Langtree practiced it when weather permitted, lying down naked every morning in the dew, with all of her beauty believing the single petal of her white skin could absorb and assume that radiating purity of liquid and light. And I admit to believing myself without question in the magical powers of dew on the cheeks and breasts of Lily Langtree, believing devotedly in the magical powers of early morning dew on the skin of her body, lolling in purple beds of birdsfoot violets, pink prairie mimosa. And I believe without doubt in the mystery of the healing energy coming from the wholehearted belief in the beneficent results of the good delights of the naked body rolling and rolling through all the silked and sun-filled, dusky-winged, sheathed and sparkled, looped and dizzied affluences of each dawn of the rolling earth. Just consider how the mere idea of it alone has already caused me to sing and sing, this whole morning long. Well, you don't need to clap. You don't need to clap every time. Anyway, I have to tell this joke because a friend of mine who was giving a reading of his own read a poem of mine before he did his reading. And afterwards, two women came up to him and said, "Do you know Patty Ann Rogers?" And he said, "Well, yes, I do." And they said, "Well, when you see her, will you please tell her that we have formed a group and we meet twice a year and we roll naked in the morning dew?" So I always like to let the audiences know that in case you want to form your own group, and because it's fast spreading across the country, I think. Well, I said I was going to read two poems that didn't have anything to do with the beautiful warm desert, but and rolling naked in the morning dew was one. And now I'm going to read a poem about toads. But I think you do have toads in the desert, and when it rains, that's when they come up and lay eggs, and everything has to happen real fast before the pond disappears, or the, right? Pardon? A spadefoot toad, okay. I don't know if I have a spadefoot toad in here. But anyway, I wrote this partially because when we were living in Houston, Hurricane Alicia went through. And, of course, Houston is far enough from the coast that there wasn't, you know, a lot of damage. Of course, we lost our electricity and nobody knew what to do because everything I could think of to do had needed electricity. Anyway, so the hurricane did come through and it was still pretty strong. You know, the wind was blowing and branches were breaking off the trees and fences were blowing down, things like that. And right below our bedroom window outside, there was probably a toad. Anyway, it was singing. It sang through this whole thing, you know, the wind is roaring and everybody's scared and we don't know what's going to happen. And this little toad was just happy as could be, had some water. Anyway, so I just thought that was kind of a power. But that's the title of this poem, The Power of Toads. But actually, it's about a different kind of power. And, you know, it's the way with all poems. They're not about what they're about. Yeah. It's what makes people mad at poets, because why don't you write what you're, you know. I had a questions from the audience at West Point once, and everybody was being very polite. They're cadets, you know, and they have to be polite. I think they get some kind of demerit or something if they're not. But finally, one raised his hand. I called on him because they were just asking him, "When did you start writing poetry and stuff like that?" Why don't poets just come right out and say what they're talking about? You know, why you beat around the bush the way you do? So anyway, I don't, just contrary, I guess. So this is ostensibly about toads, but you know, it's also about something else. And they're human beings in the end. So if you're not interested in toads, just hang on, and there's a human interest as we get to the end. Okay. But everyone should be interested in toads, right? Absolutely. The Power of Toads. The oak toad and the red spotted toad love their love in a spring rain, calling and calling, breeding through a stormy evening, clasped atop their mates. Who wouldn't sing, anticipating the belly pressed hard against a female's spine in the steady rain below writhing skies, the safe, moist, jelly affluence of a final exaltation. There might be some toads who actually believe that the loin-shaking thunder of the banks, the evening filled with damp, the warm, softening mud and rising riverlets are the facts of their own persistent performance. Maybe they think that when they sing more than songs, creating rain and mist by their voices,
initiating the union of water and dusk. Females materializing on the banks, shaped perfectly by their calls. And some toads may be convinced they have forced the heavens to twist and moan by the continual expansion of their lung sacs pushing against the dusk. And some might believe the splitting light, the soaring gray they see above them, are nothing but a vision of the longing in their groins, a fertile spring heaven caught in its entirety at the pit. And they might be right. Who knows whether these broken heavens could exist tonight, separate from trills and toad ringings. Maybe the particles of this rain descending on the pond are nothing but the visual manifestation of whistles and cascading love clicks in the shore grasses. Raindrops finding earth and coitus could very well be known here as one. We could investigate the causal relationship between rainstorm and love by pondside if we wished. We could lie down in the grasses by the water's edge and watch to see exactly how the heavens were moved, thinking hard of thunder, imagining all the courses that slow, clean waters might take across our bodies, believing completely in the rolling and pressing power of heavens and thighs. And in the end, we might be glad, even if all we discovered for certain was the slick, sweet promise of good love beneath dark skies, inside warm rains. Well, see, I suggest that after you have done the rolling part, then you do this other investigation. It's a scientific experiment, right? Well, anyway, that leads into a couple of love poems. This first one is entitled Love Song. It's all right together with me tonight, how your whole body trembles exactly like the locust, establishing its dry cymbal quivering even in the farthest branch-tipped leaves of the tree in which it screams. Lying next to me, it's all right how similar you become to the red deer agitated pacing on the open plains by the sea, in its sidling haunch against haunch, in the final mastery of its mounting. And it's all right in those moments how you possess the same single-minded madness of the opened wood poppy, circling and circling, the same wild strength of its golden eye. It's true, you're no better than the determined boar, snorkeling and rooting, no better than the ridiculous ruffled drumming of the prairie chicken, no better than the explosion of the milkweed pod, spilling the white furl of the moon deep in the midnight field. You're completely indistinguishable from the enraged sand myrtle, absurd in its scarlet spread on the rocky bluffs. But it's all right. Don't you know this is precisely what I seek? Mad myself, develop every last droop and pearl-dropped oval, every nip and cry and needle-fine boring, every drooping, spore-rich tassel of oak flower, all the whistling, wing-beating, heavy-tipped matings of an entire prairie of grasses, every wafted, moaning seed hook you can possibly manage to bring to me, that this is exactly what I contrive to take into my arms with you again and again. I read that poem in Missoula once, and afterwards two men came up. They were brothers from Boulder. What that has to do with anything, I don't know. But anyone wanted to know what book that poem was in. And they said, we want to buy that book because we want our wives to read that poem to us. So anybody wants to know, it's in this book. Okay, the next one, this is another love poem. I'm not going to read love poems all night, so don't be counting on that. Now, I know you've got a lot of hummingbirds around here, and I'm going to try to, hoping to go to the museum tomorrow and see the hummingbird aviary, right, where they're zooming all around. So you probably know that the male hummingbird courts the female by displaying in front of her, flying up and then dropping and then flying up and then dropping. And this evidently is a wonderful, well, it works, right? So it's pretty exciting. Anyway, I think it's pretty exciting. See, I like all this. I think it's wonderful to be a female and have the guys all doing things, you know, trying to impress you, and right? So, anyway, I think it's romantic. So, this poem is titled, The Hummingbird, A Seduction. If I were a female hummingbird perched still and quiet on an upper myrtle branch in the spring afternoon, and if you were a male alone in the whole heavens before me, having parted yourself for me from cedar top and honeysuckle and earth down, your body hovering in midair far away from jewelweed, thistle, and bee balm. And if I watched how you fell, plummeting before me, and how you rose again and fell with such mastery that I believed for a moment you were the sky, and the red-marked bird diving inside your circumference was just the physical revelation of the light's most perfect desire. And if I saw your sweeping and sucking performance of swirling egg and semen in the air, the weaving, twisting vision of red petal and nectar and soaring rump, the rush of your wing and its grand confusion of arcing and splitting created completely out of nothing, just for me. Then when you came down to me, I would call you my own spinning bloom of ruby sage, my funneling storm of sunlit sperm and pollen, only breathless piece of scarlet sky, and I would bless the base of each of your feathers and touch the tine of string muscles binding your wings and taste the odor of your glistening oils and hunt the honey in your crimson flare. And I would take you and take you and take you deep into any kind of nest you ever wanted. Well, I said, too bad my husband's not a hummingbird. But, you know, he does his best. We have to help our human husbands along. Right. Okay, the next poem is entitled Geocentric. Indecent, self-soiled, bilious reek of turnip and toadstool decay, dribbling the black oil of wilted succulents, the brown fester of rotting orchids, in plain view that stain of stinkhorn down your front, that leaking roil of black bracket fungi down your back, you purple-haired grainy fuzz smolder of refuse, fathering fumes and boils and powdery mildews, enduring the constant interruption of sink-mire flatulence, contagious with ear wax, corn smut, blister rust, backwash and graveyard debris, rich with manure bog and dry rot, harboring not only egg-addled garbage and wrinkled lip of orange mold, but also the clotted breath of overripe radish and burnt leek, bearing every dank, malodorous rut and scarp, all sulfur fissures and fetid hillside seepages, old, old, dependable, engendering forever the stench and stretch and warm seethe of inevitable putrefaction. Nobody loves you as I do. Well, I have two jokes to tell about that. One was that a poet came up to me after I read that once and said he didn't know whether that was about the earth or my husband. And the other was, oh, this isn't a joke. It's really why I wrote the poem, because those of us who kind of enjoy the natural world and write about it are always being accused of refusing to look at the repulsive and bad things about the natural world. So I just made a list of every repulsive thing I could think of and then said, so what? You know, I love you anyway. All right, the next three poems are going to be about death, because that's poets have to write about death. That's one of our subjects. And anyway, I think we ought to write about death, because, you know, it's like I said, if it wasn't for death, we probably wouldn't be writing any poems at all, right? Because if you have infinity to do it in, why do it today? So anyway, so, you know, we got to hurry here, because we don't have much time, so we got to write all we can get written in our few brief years. Oh, okay. So that's what the subject is going to be here for the next three poems. And really, I have six more poems, so these three and then three more. So the first one is called The Next Story. All morning long, they kept coming back. The jays, five of them, blue, gray, purple banded, strident, disruptive. They screamed with their whole bodies from the branches of the pine, tipped forward, heads toward earth, and swept across the lawn into the oleanders, dipping low as they flew over the half skull and beak, the blood end of the one wing lying intact, over the fluff of feathers scattered and drifting occasionally, easily as dandelion, all that the cat had left. Back and forth, past one another, pausing as if listening, then sharply cutting the morning again into shard upon shard of frantic and crested descent, jagged slivers of raucous outrage, they kept at it, crying singly, together, alternately, as if on cue, discordant anthem. The pattern of their inconsolable fear could be seen against the flat spring sky as identical to the pattern made by that unmendable shatter of disjointed rubbish on the lawn all morning long. Mothers, fathers, our kind, tell me again that death doesn't matter. Tell me it's just a limitation of vision, a fold of landscape, a deep flax and poppy-filled gully hidden on the hill, a pleat in our perception, a somersault of existence, natural, even beneficent, even a gift, the only key to the red lacquered door at the end of the hall. Water within water, those old stories. But this time, whatever is said when it's said will have to be more reverent and more rude, more absolute, more convincing than these five J's who have become the five wheeling spokes and stays of perfect lament, who, without knowing anything, have accurately matched the black beaks and spread shoulders of their bodies to all the shrill bird-shaped histories of grief. We'll have to be demanding enough, subtle enough, shocking enough, sovereign enough, right enough to rouse me, to move me from this window where I have pressed my forehead hard against the unyielding pain, unyielding all morning long. Oh, okay. I forgot the, well, okay. The next poem is, "The dead never fight against anything." It's always been that way. They've allowed themselves to be placed knees to chin in the corners of caves or in holes in the earth and covered with stones. They've let their fingers be curled around old spears or diadems or favorite dolls, the stems of cut flowers. Whether their skulls were cracked open and their brains eaten by kin, or whether their brains were pulled by tongs through their nostrils and thrown into the dog's dish as waste, are matters that have never concerned them. They have never offered resistance to tied to rocks below the sea, left for days and nights until their flesh washed away, or likewise to being placed high in jungle trees or high on scaffolds alone in the desert until buzzards, vultures, and harpy eagles stripped their bones bare. They have never minded jackals nosing at their haunches, coyotes gnawing at their breasts. The dead have always been so purely tolerant. They've let their bones be rubbed with ointments, ornamented with ochre, used as kitchen ladles and spoons. They've been imperturbably indifferent to the removal of all their entrails, the resulting cavities filled with palm wine, aromatic spices. They have lain complacently as their abdomens were infused by syringe with cedar oil. They've allowed all seven natural openings of their bodies to be closed with gold dust. They've been shrunken and their mouths sewn shut. They've been wrapped in gummed linen, bound upright facing east, hung above coals and smoked, their ears stuffed with onions, sent to sea on flaming pyres. Not one has ever given a single sign of dissent. Oblivious to abuse, even today, you can hit them and pinch them and kick them. You can shake them, scream into their ears. You can cry. You can kiss them and whisper and moan, smooth their combed and parted hair, touch the lips that yesterday spoke, beseech, entreat with your finest entreaty. Still, they stare without deviation, straight into distance and direction. Old stumps, old shameless logs, rigid knurls, snow-faced, pitiless, pitiless betrayal. Actually, it's going to be seven poems because I don't know how I left this poem out. The Justification of the Horned Lizard poem. Because, see, I wrote The Dead Never Fight Against Anything after I wrote Justification of the Horned Lizard, and I realized it was the flip version of that poem. Because the dead don't fight against anything, and that seems a betrayal of those of us who are still alive and struggling with things. And this poem is about the horned lizard, and probably everybody here knows about horned lizards, right? That their method of defense is to spray blood out of their eyes at whatever they feel is threatening them. That's one of their defense. Then to bury themselves in the sand, right? Am I right? And I was going to tell, well, I know someone who said that when he was a boy, one thing he used to do was, he lived around the desert, was to, when he could catch baby horned lizards, and he would put one in his mouth and then go up to his mother and open his mouth and stick his tongue out to show her. So I thought that sounded just like a boy. There are only a very few ethnobiologists and boys who are interested in horned lizards, right? Okay. So this is my poem for desert people. Justification of the horned lizard. I hope I don't mispronounce anything. If I do, I'm sure I'll be told about it after this reading. By someone. Justification of the horned lizard. I don't know why the horned lizard wants to live. It's so ugly. Short, prickly horns and scowling eyes. Lipless smile forced forever by bone. Hideous, scaly hollow where its nose should be. I don't know what the horned lizard has to live for. Skittering over the sun-irritated sand. Scraping the hot, dusty brambles. It never sees anything but gravel and grit. Thorns and stickery insects, the towering creosote bush, the ocotillo and its whip-like branches, the severe edges of the Spanish dagger, even in waves in the current by the bank, or the blue fronds of the water clover. It will never have a smooth, glistening belly of white like the bullfrog, or a dew-heavy trill like a mating toad. It will never slip easily through mud like the skink or squat in the dank humus at the bottom of a decaying forest in daytime. It will never be free of dust. The only drink it will ever know is in the body of a bug. And the horned lizard possesses nothing noble. Embarrassing tail, warty hide covered with sharp, dirty scales. No touch to its body, even from its own kind, could ever be delicate or caressing. I don't know why the horned lizard wants to live. Yet threatened, it burrows frantically into the sand with a surprisingly determined fury of forehead, limbs, and ribs. Pursued, it even fights for itself, almost rising up, posturing on its legs, propelling blood out of its eyes in tight, straight streams shot directly at the source of its possible extinction. It fights for itself, almost rising up, as if the performance of that act, the posture, the propulsion of the blood itself, were justification enough and the only reason needed. See, to me, that's one of the things that's so affirming about the natural world. That there's no question that life is good. And so, you know, you walk out into a landscape, there's nothing there but yes. Yes, you know. Put asphalt over us, we're going to come up through it anyway. So, that kind of thing. And anyway, I wrote this also because I'd been reading a lot of contemporary poems in which poets were complaining about their life. You know, and I thought, I don't know any poet that has a life as bad as the horned lizard. And yet the horned lizard seems to think it's worth fighting for. So. Okay. It's getting warm in here, isn't it, a little bit? This is the last poem. That poem was not about death, obviously. It was about life. But this is the last poem about death. And the title is Trinity. I wish something slow and gentle and good would happen to me. A patient and prolonged kind of happiness coming in the same way evening comes to a wide-branched sycamore standing in an empty field. Each branch not succumbing, not taken, but feeling its entire existence, a willing revolution of cells. Even asleep, feeling a decision of gold spreading over its ragged bark and motionless knots of seed, over every naked, vulnerable juncture. Each leaf becoming a lavender shell, a stem deep line of violet turning slowly and carefully to possess exactly the pale and patient color of the sky coming. I wish something that slow and that patient would come to me. Maybe like the happiness growing when the lover's hand, easy on the thigh or easy on the breast, moves like late light moves over the branches of a sycamore, causing a slow revolution of decision in the body. Even asleep, feeling the spread of hazy coral and ivory gray rising through the legs and spine to alter the belief in the eyes. Feeling the slow turn of wave after wave of acquiescence moving from the inner throat to the radiance of a gold belly to a bone center of purple. An easy, slow turning happiness of possession like that prolonged. I wish something that gentle and that careful and that patient would come to me. Death might be that way if one knew how to wait for it, if death came easily and slowly, if death were good. All right, the three last poems I'm going to read are all bedtime poems. Put you to sleep. And the one is titled, When at Night. Suppose all of you came in the dark, each one, up to my bed while I was sleeping. Suppose one of you took my hand without waking me and touched my fingers, moved your lips the length of each one down into the crotch with your tongue and up again, slowly sucking the nipple of each knuckle with your eyes closed. Suppose two of you were at my head, the breath of one in my ear like a bird moth fluttering at a silk screen, the other fully engaged, mouth tasting of sweetmeats and liquors, kissing my mouth. Suppose another drew the covers down to my feet, slipped the loops from the buttons, spread my gown, ministering mouth again around the dark of each breast, pulling and puckering in the way that water in a stir pulls and puckers a fallen bell flower to itself. Two at my shoulders to ease the gown away, take it down past my waist and hips, over my ankles to the end of the bed. One of you is made to adore the belly. One of you is obsessed with dampness. At my bent knees now, another watching. At my parted thighs, another. And one to oversee the separation. And one to guard the joining. And one to equal my trembling. And one to protect my moaning. And at dawn, if everything were put in place again, closing, sealing, my legs together straight, the quilt folded and tucked to my chin, if all of you stepped back, away, into your places, into the translucence of glass at the window, into the ground breezes swelling the grasses, into the river of insect rubbings below the field, and the light expanding the empty spaces of the elm, back into the rising black of the hawk, deepening the shallow sky, and we all woke then, so much happier than before. Well, there wouldn't be anything wrong in that, would there? See, I have to tell you, if that's, in case you think we've just experienced an orgy, the title, you know where the title comes from? When at Night? Yes. So, it's, When at Night I Go to Bed, 14 angels around my head. So these are all angels, so it's all right. So. the next poem now. you can go to bed with that poem if you wish, or here's another poem about sleeping, because, see, I think there's something about sleeping or watching someone else sleep. It hardly matters what, well, I won't say this entirely since we've had a crime committed like recently while someone was asleep, but typically the person looks so, I want to say innocent, but it's not, that's not the exact word. It's something we know about life when we see someone asleep. And this was a poem in which I tried to deal that question, and I don't know that I did it completely, but anyway, that was the impetus of the poem. When you watch us sleeping, when you see us lying scented in our night clothes, the patchwork quilt wadded at our feet, coverlet kicked aside, when you see us still at midnight, our bare arms covered with the moon shadows of the hemlock by the window, our hands latent and half open on the pillows by our heads. When you come upon any of us, buried but breathing, close to the earth, motionless as oak leaves beneath drifts of oak leaves, or curled inside silk body vases hanging from greasewood and vetch, or sprawled languid under the broad branches of a baobab in summer heat, when you hear us humming hoarsely sometimes, scarcely wheezing, murmuring like white hens at their roost, when you watch the grill on the banyan, cool and slender as a pod, the onyx grain of his eye closed deep in green sunlight, when you can see how he obviously possesses in his body, even in the slack scaly skin of rose beneath his jaw, even in the posing net of his ribs, even in the corpuscle of blood at the tip of his tail, how he possesses in his body alone all the power he needs to rise and declare not merely truth, but rapture. The living body asleep, so great a sum of beauty that a billion zeros follow it, the eyes sealing the head so tightly during those moments that the infinity of possible heavens inside can be clearly perceived by anyone. When you watch us sleeping, when you see the purest architecture of the ear, the explicit face of the knee, the guiltless, unforgiving, adoring, sweet momentary tremble of claim in the breast, aren't you sorry? Don't you love us? The last poem then is entitled Before I Wake. You know, it's a kind of a takeoff of the old prayer, Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. You know, I used to say that, Now I pray, lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. But I think it's I pray thee, Lord, T-H-E-E, whether that makes a difference to anybody. It kind of does. You know, the rhythm of it changes. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. Before I wake. The turning of the marsh marigold coming slowly into its emergent bloom underwater. The turning of the coral sands over themselves and over their dunes and over the scratchings of scarab beetles turning over the dung of the desert doe. The pivoting of the eye of the bluefish turning inside the drawing light of its multiple school, shifting its constellation in the dark sea. This is the prayer of sleep in which I lay myself down to dream. The quiet enclosed by the burrowing wolf spider dragging its egg sac to the surface to sun. The stillness covered by the barren strawberry making its fleshless seed on the rocky hill. The study in the desert mushroom knotting itself in the arid heat. The silence of the fetal seahorses bound in the pouch of their father. This is the dream of the soul in which I lay myself down to pray. And I've asked the ocean of the hollow web of the elm making leaf And I've asked the inward motion of every glinting fin making the focus of the carp. And I've asked the involution of the egg buds carried in the dark inside the cowbird circling overhead. And I've asked the tight coiling and breaking of light traveling in the beads of the sawgrass and the net of the sea oat splitting and binding and splitting again over and over across the open lands to keep me in this dream tonight through one prayer more. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Now join us for a reception in the back.